back to the Rule of Three. Tim Slagle on this end.
And Brian Miller.
And this is the Saturday after Thanksgiving. We were going to do a Black Friday episode, but a family was in town for Brian.
Yeah. And, yeah, it was good. It was nice. Did you have a pleasant Thanksgiving overall, by the way?
Yeah, well, yeah, my Thanksgiving weekend is still going. I'm still at my mom's house.
Ah.
And yeah, I'm recording from her den. So we might actually have a visitor.
I hope she's not union, you know, otherwise she's just like the carpenters working on my house. We can't pay your ma scale, you know.
Yeah, I had to chase my nephew out. He actually wanted to listen, and I said, you know, two things. Number one is you're only going to hear half, and number two, you're going to have to keep it down.
How old's your nephew, by the way?
Will be 16.
Oh, okay, sure.
So, yeah, so he's...
I was picturing a little tyke at your feet or something like that. I was picturing like a little kid with a cowlick and like really big eyes staring up at you.
No, he's 15 and has a really goofy laugh. So it actually might have been fun to have him sit in, but
can you send him to my show tonight? I could use an extra.
Where are you working?
Joke Joint Comedy Club, actually, in St. Paul.
Uh huh.
I kid, cool. Actually, it was a good couple of shows last night.
Oh, cool.
We did a pre-Thanksgiving show on Wednesday, which was fun. People are always Black excited Friday to show. Get away from their families, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's it's everyone's excited to come home, and then about a half hour later realize why they left.
Yeah, like what if we all stared at another guy who talked and we didn't talk to each other at all? And that's where I come in.
Let's go drinking. I here at this house we have a tradition of playing board games. Do you do the family board game thing with on holidays?
You know, we don't, but I'm kind of surprised that we don't, because that's my family likes, you know, especially throwing some booze, you know, that'd be right up their alley. My wife and I play board game. We play a lot of cribbage and Yahtzee and the occasional Scrabble.
We actually, last summer when we got together, we got lawn dice.
Is it like lawn darts but less deadly?
Yeah, yeah, they're about the size of croquet balls. And yeah, and you can actually play Yahtzee out on the canopy of nature.
Oh, that's pretty nice. Get you. it's like a Victorian thing. Take some oxygen and play some Yahtzee. Women in hats gently rolling them.
Yeah, and the size of them, it somewhat reminded me of an Avengers episode I think I saw where they actually had real people on a chessboard. And I think I think when you, rather than take someone off, you had to kill them when you or got killed, or so it was something like, you know, it was very Avengers.
What you're saying is your family's lawn games are really intense.
Well, it got intense. It's we're all very competitive. Certain games are no longer allowed at the gatherings.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Monopoly and Risk, you know, power and money both don't mix well with our family.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They should invent a religion board game just to complete the trifecta, right?
And
just
I'm
to make
always...
everyone super uncomfortable.
Myself and I, and they, it's been forbidden. No one's, I had this idea that it would be really fun to play Monopoly for real money sometime.
Ooh.
To actually divide up the bank and then, you know, turn it into a denomination that everyone, you know, could afford.
Sure.
You know, so that like the dollars maybe would be a penny and the you know, and then you divide how much is in the bank and everyone has, that's what you have to chip in. And have at it.
That's kind of a good idea. I can go for that $50 buy-in or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And the cool thing about it is once you start introducing real capital into the game, the game can literally go on forever.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Because if you're bankrupt, you can actually pull out your wallet.
Huh. I like that idea. Monopoly is the most fun game in the world for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then it's a bit of a slog. I think the number of Monopoly games I've finished in my life It's probably about five.
My sister's that way. I always play to the end. I've always been able to play to the end. But my sister is that way, is that Monopoly and Risk for her are boring.
Risk I like. I like the do you have a Risk strategy? Do you have a favored nation? I was always a fan of a fortifying Australia.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say. I think that's where everyone starts.
Yeah, if you can, you get that.
Yeah, just keep on amassing armies there in New Zealand, and once you've got this huge phalanx, you can just slowly start sweeping across Europe.
I wonder why New Zealand has never gotten the hint on that. All these years, they're like, the Risk has given them the strategy, they could dominate the world, and they've never even tried once. I'm kind of disappointed in New Zealand.
Well, you know, you're assuming there, Brian, that it's that point of the game.
Oh, that's true. Ooh, I have a lot of family in New Zealand. I should apply for dual citizenship just in case it goes down. You know.
Yeah. For all we know, is one day we're going to wake up and New Zealand invades India, and it's going to be what?
Whoever's got Kamchatka's like, oh, damn it. This thing is so hard to hold.
Boy, I didn't see that coming. Well, what we did this year, I'm going to give a plug to my niece. What we did this year is my niece actually helped create a name for Ellen DeGeneres Incorporated, and I hope I don't besmirch. Cause I don't know the exact division, but. She works under Ellen DeGeneres, and they came up with a game called Heads Up a little while ago, and this I think is their second game release.
Hmm.
And the idea of the game, it's like a trivia game, and a question comes up, and everybody who's playing has to come up with an answer, a made up answer, and then you get multiple choice. You get the real answer with the made up answers, and you get a point if you guess the right answer. And you get a point for everyone that guesses your wrong answer.
I like that. There's kind of creativity on one end, and
yeah, it's called Psych. You can download it on your smartphone device. It's a free download, but then you get ads. Then I think there's a certain price you can pay to get no ads. And then here's the kicker: is that you get so many questions, and then you have to buy more.
Oh. Well, that Ellen didn't see that Ellen. I bet she plays Monopoly all the way to the end.
And the fun part about it is that we have a part of the families over in California.
Oh, you can include them in on the family board game night.
So we actually did that. We actually my mom's got a Skype a smart TV, so we actually set up Skype on the smart TV. And then they did that as well over in California, and they set up their Skype. And then we were able to, because the game's on the phones and you play over the internet, we were all able to join in on the game.
Huh?
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it's a very like digitally bucolic somehow.
Well, I thought it was kind of it made a kind of a William Gibson Thanksgiving in cyberspace.
Yeah, a very William Gibson Thanksgiving. Less popular album than you might think. What's your favorite all-time game? What's the one game that you like above all others?
Game I like above all others. That's hard. It waxes and wanes. But big on Monopoly for a while, big on Risk for a while. I like standard poker. That's always big. I don't know if Scrabble. I think right now is it. I think maybe Scrabble.
I'm a cribbage man myself. Sport of, the sport of prisoners and old ladies.
Just the way, old British theater queens, I think.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, my wife and I get in some vicious cribbage fights, so it's very satisfying. That's our version of like, we don't need a divorce lawyer, we'll just settle it on the cribbage board.
And I think that settles our first segment. Play the game. Everybody play the game. The second segment. I don't think we have to do any introductions. We're not going to do that. We've changed the format here. You know who it is because you've been obviously listening since the first part. I was perusing through the paper last night. I was going over the Drudge Report, and I came across a story that just for some reason just fascinates me. Is a fleet of 11 ghost ships containing the rotting remains of sailors has washed up on the Japanese coastline, sparking an investigation in the country. The mysterious ships have given rise to numerous conspiracy theories in the country as authorities battle to discover the identities of the bodies.
It's a great story, and of course it happened in Japan. It's so spooky and weird.
It just basically, I'll surmise the story here, is that there's these old boats that just started washing up full of dead sailors. And they have no idea who the sailors are. They have no idea what happened to them. They have no idea how long ago they left. They know nothing. They just know that these ships full of corpses just kind of landed on their beach like a wet New England whale.
Or a ship in a bottle. They're very anachronistic boats, or almost like ahistorical or something. I mean, the pictures of the boats make them look like they could have been built 2 days ago, but they could have been built 50 years ago.
Yeah, they look like a souvenir junk that you might pick up in Chinatown.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's made out of like popsicle sticks and bark or something.
Yeah, they're wooden, and so you feel like they should be these massive old ships, but then, you know, when you see the scale on them, you're like, oh wait, those don't fit that many people.
Per ship. Yeah, which is why I think there are 11 ships with 20 bodies, so there was like 2 people per ship. Which is kind of weird too.
Boy, you really have to hope you like the guy you're with on that one, huh? Jeez, how about drawing the who's gonna go with Larry? Oh.
Well, apparently nobody did.
Here's the thing: we think there were 2 bodies per ship. You know, it depends on how hungry they were. There might have been.
Yeah, that each ship that was the last two, and they died from the opposite corners of the ship, staring at each other, envisioning the turkey.
Yep. Or, you know, maybe it's a lesson in democracy, is that all of those ships started with 3 sailors, but then there was a vote.
That's funny. Well, no, the democracy could go until it got to a split vote.
Absolutely, exactly. That's where we get down to the 2, and you go, well.
So even if it was 10, it was okay. You lose, you lose, you lose, and then yeah, that's exactly. It's 2 per boat, and exactly, there was 11 boats, 20. So am I counting right? Were there a couple boats with just one then?
There must have been a couple boats with just one.
Yeah, where 2 boats discovered mob rule, apparently. Yeah.
That or one guy just really hated the other and he's like, I'm taking my chances with the sharks.
or the other guy got, I'm bigger than you.
Yeah.
I'm bigger than you. So no, we're going to. But the idea of ghost ships for me has always been a fascinating thing.
Oh, absolutely.
There was a Typee by Melville.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Have you read it?
I have not read it. I'm familiar with it from school, but I've not actually read it.
Yeah, there was it's a couple guys bail on a whaling from a whaling ship, because what would happen back then is that when you had a whaling ship, you would get an investor that would pay to repair the ship and stock the ship, and a lot of times own the ship. And you got the ship, and basically he put in all this money, and you have to bring back a whale. And it doesn't matter how long you're out there; your job is to bring back a whale. And there was a legend among whalers that certain ships never found a whale. And that centuries later, that those ships are still sailing the earth with people that don't even know that they're dead, still looking for a whale.
Mm.
And essentially, the book starts out is that two guys bail. They think that they're on one of those ships and they don't want to.
Oh, right. Things aren't looking so well. So
right,
good.
Right. They don't want to be whaling for eternity. So so they jump ship. And then end up on an island, Polynesian island, and no more. I don't have to do more spoilers for the story. Well, okay, I'll do one because this one has always fascinated me because the book was written like in 1840, and they took a bunch of supplies before they jumped ship, and they jumped, they swam, and they were worried that there were cannibals on the island, but they made sure they brought a bunch of supplies that they could trade with the cannibals to save their lives. And when they got there, sure enough, the first thing they do is they spot the cannibals. And the one guy reaches into his pocket and starts pulling out silk scarves. And the narrator said that it looked vaguely like that old magician's trick of the endless scarf.
Oh, my.
So... even in 1840, that one was hack. is that people in clubs in vaudeville or whatever it was then, or the hippodrome or wherever they were, would see the guy starting to pull out a scarf that just kept coming, and they go, "Oh, not this one again."
I always wondered when was that funny. You know, when was the first one? You know, it seemed like he was getting a handkerchief with the darn thing. He just kept coming. I never laughed so hard in my life. Like, that wasn't funny the first time it happened. Some things that stick around in tradition, you're like, I have no idea how that persisted.
Or what year was the brassiere added to the end?
Oh, right. Yeah, well, at least that one's got a... At least there's a notion of surprise to it.
Well, and there was at one point.
But yeah.
The first time it was done. So
that guy
was
the Andy Kaufman of scarf pulling.
So anyway, the notion of ghost ships, it just always entertained a portion of my mind, it occurred to me when a friend started working cruise ships.
Ooh, ghost cruise ship!
Is that he had run into a guy that said the last thing you want to do is do too many of these. He said, but because for a comic and a cruise ship, it's just really comfortable. You just everything's be it food, you got drink, you're 2 weeks in the Caribbean, the money's really good, and it's really easy to sign on to another cruise after you get done. And basically, they know that, and they want to keep you out here long enough that you lose all your contacts, that the agents think no longer bother trying to book you, that the clubs forget who you are, and at that point you can do nothing more than cruise ships.
You're a ghost comic.
Exactly. So I imagine that there's these cruise ships that these comics don't even know that they're actually taking people who have recently died to the netherworld, and they are the sole entertainment of these people. They don't even know they died. I don't remember signing up for a cruise. Oh, look, he's doing the thing with the handkerchief.
Yeah. What's on the buffet? Same thing as last night. Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens, you know, like David Byrne says. You know, you're just on that ship.
There was actually a movie like that. It was like almost a Twilight Zone episode movie. And all I know is that I think a John Garfield. I can't remember the actor.
Oh, you mean the movie Ghost Ship?
Ghost Ship, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They remade it. It was I believe it was an old William Castle movie, and then they remade it under the Dark Castle banner, which where they've been remaking a lot of those William Castle, House on Haunted Hill type movies.
Huh.
The remake is really bad, but it's fun. But the original is quite good.
Yeah, the original, that's the one, a bomb dropped on like the cab on the way to the ship or something like that. And is this the one you're thinking of, or you think of something else?
Yeah.
And then they all wake up on a cruise ship and don't realize that they're all dead.
Yes. I think that's the one I'm thinking of, yes. That's... I like the idea of the oh, by the way, just to give some people some at least a tinkle of closure on that. So they think it was North Korean ships, which I think is an interesting theory because it explains the weird, like I said, ahistorical nature of them, because North Korea is this place where, like, time kind of doesn't exist there. It's kind of a ghost country.
Yeah, they don't know what what year they left, because everything out of North Korea is built with popsicle sticks and bark.
Yeah, the whole country is just drifting. They don't know what time it is either. It's like a whole country full of cruise ship comics. As the saying goes.
And speaking of drifting, we're 15 seconds over. Catch you on the next second. There's a port on a western bay, and it serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk
of. And welcome back to the Rule of Three. Wrapping up the Thanksgiving here show, talking about some Thanksgiving movies. I saw a very good new movie out, probably just now trickling out into your town, Spotlight, which is the Tom McCarthy wrote and directed it. He did The Visitor and The Station Agent. And Spotlight is a journalistic account of the Boston Globe's attempt to uncover the Catholic Church priest abuse scandal.
I'm just going to sound ignorant. I don't know any of the movies you just mentioned. I knew.
They're all very good. Tom McCarthy makes these really quiet movies that are just fantastic. If you watch The Wire, are you a Wire fan?
I never got into The Wire. I've watched it enough to know that it was good.
Sure.
But I never wanted to get taken into it.
And once you're in, you're into it. It's very immersive. But he was an actor in The Wire as well. He played Templeton, the shady journalist, ironically, I guess, in this case.
Oh, Tom McCarthy's the actor.
Yes, Tom McCarthy. Well, yeah, he was the actor in The Wire, but then he has a little side career writing, directing.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
He also wrote he co-wrote the screenplay for the movie Up as well, the Pixar movie.
Wow.
Yeah, really talented guy, and his movies are very different. They're all very different from one another.
My guess is he wrote the a wife has a miscarriage portion rather than the talking dog portion.
I think you might be spot on with that.
That's the funny thing about Up is that it's actually two movies.
Yeah, it's like a 10-minute most devastating movie you've ever seen.
Yeah, it's half of it. Half of it is a very adult, very very painful, very real Pixar animation, and the other half is just a goofy talking dog cartoon.
But you're so damn happy to get that talking dog after the first half. You're like, I love this dog. This is great. I'm not depressed at all when this dog is on screen. Every movie should that must be that maybe that's why Disney movies are so successful. They do something brutal right at the beginning, and then you're just dying for a rabbit to sing a song or something like that.
Actually, you know, I think that there wasn't anything in between Bambi calling back for his mother and that. I don't think there was that Disney had anything heart wrenching.
Well, Finding Nemo that has the. The mother dies because the son wanders off.
Okay, yeah, you're right. Finding Nemo. And I believe Old Yeller might have been after.
Might have been after. Live action, though, a little different.
But there was a long period where Disney would not do that. And in fact, something someone pointed out to me was The Little Mermaid in the actual Hans Christian Andersen story.
Mm-hmm.
The Little Mermaid does not... get away. The Little Mermaid essentially sells her soul to the Sea Witch, cannot make the man love her without her voice, and eventually becomes property of the Sea Witch.
A lot harder to sell plush toys and Happy Meal figurines out of it. No.
I know, but it's, you know, but it was written as a cautionary tale. The moral of the story is listen to your dad.
Sure, which they kind of, yeah, it's interesting that the cartoon has to kind of get rid of any kind of lesson in order to be more palatable.
Right. There's a, oh my gosh, Who's the guy that did Barcelona and he did...
Whit Stillman.
Whit Stillman, yeah.
Amazing movie. I love Barcelona.
There's a speech in one of those. I'm not sure which one. It's Barcelona, Last Days of Disco. And then
Metropolitan.
Yeah, yeah, I love those. Did not care so much for the fourth one that he did.
No, the women and the singing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice try. But it's like, you know, sometimes it's good to go Salinger.
Yes, I respect the ambition, but that one was a bit of a miss. But
yeah, but there was one monologue in one of those films about the lady and the tramp being just causing really messed up girls, because when the girl brings home a human version of the tramp, his dad wonders where the heck he went wrong. It was essentially, well, you told him that we taught girls that finding a chicken thief with a heart of gold is a noble thing.
So back to Spotlight though, real good. So you should definitely check this out. It's a very movies about journalism are very rarely done well, I think. It's because it's kind of a boring thing. It's a hard thing to make exciting. And they make it exciting without kind of ginning up in a conflict. No one runs into any rooms, stop the presses or anything. You know, it's about the gradual accumulation of information, but it plays out like a detective story with some interesting character conflicts in there, because there are all these Catholic guys who are finding this out and they're very torn about how to report this story.
Huh.
It's Michael Keaton and Liev Schreiber, Rachel McAdams. Very, very well done movie. I mean, just got the pacing of a murder mystery, but there's no violence in it, and it's not as heavy as you might think, given the heavy topic, because it's more about the investigation. So it's not, you know.
Interestingly, this Thanksgiving holiday, isn't that there's two films out about journalism. Is also, didn't Trumbo come out?
Yeah, Trumbo. I'm looking forward to see that. Dalton Trumbo, very underappreciated figure in American history, I think.
Yeah, I think he's overappreciated.
Really? He's so interesting. I mean, he wrote Papillon, and he wrote Johnny Get Your Gun. His Steve Martin dated his daughter. He's got all kinds of crazy.
I did not know.
Yeah, he's intersects with all these historical figures, and he lived on this kind of artist. Kind of, he lived an interesting life in exile in Mexico for a while. That was itself kind of a bucolic writer's getaway before he comes back.
Yeah, it's whether he's interesting or just a professional martyr. I don't know.
But he wrote so many great screenplays. I mean, undeniably, the guy was just an excellent screenwriter.
But how many writers from that era really do get credit for writing all those excellent screenplays?
True. Just yes and no. Just, I mean, there's also the producer's era.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So.
But he wrote an incredible disparity, or a really, kind of, I guess, like old Tom McCarthy there, a real breadth of stuff. You know, he kind of toes into, you know, Papillon is very different from, I forget the romantic comedy that he wrote. Trumbo is a real broad, and Johnny Get Your Gun, I think, is very good.
Okay.
You're not a Trumbo fan?
The whole too much to get into this one.
yeah, let's get into the blacklist with 35 seconds left in this
basically,
segment.
Yeah, basically, in short, I think I actually read a piece. This will sum it up nicely. Is that I was kind of looking over some stuff, and apparently Trumbo himself said, "If there's nothing wrong with being a communist, why do you have to keep it secret?" And that's kind of my opinion summed up just as the clock strikes 10.
There you go.
And
go see Spotlight, go see Trumbo. Don't get blacklisted.
And we'll see you next week.